Welcome to The Sandbox, a Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast. Participate in the podcast and get your level 7 access by calling 304-837-2278 or go to goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Dave.
Welcome, everybody, to The Sandbox, a Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast, where we are, as always, ready to comply. My name is Mike.
And I'm Dave, and this is show number 96 of The Sandbox, where we'll be discussing Season 5, Episode 17 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., entitled The Honeymoon, which aired April 13th, 2018.
And this episode was written by the ever more prolific married couple, James and Charlotte Oliver, and it was directed by Gary A. Brown. And we're moving right along with this plot line where we're trying to follow maybe a little bit more about what Fitz and Simmons are up to on their supposed honeymoon, although I think they would like to have a real one at some point. But definitely an interesting development that ended with that surprise ending. But other than that, I'm still kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah, what? You don't think shooting at faceless mechs is a nice honeymoon?
Come on. Yeah, who wouldn't want that? Especially also accompanied by Elena as a third wheel, but that's okay. But yeah, we had a lot of things going on with this episode, but I just wanted to mention the really strange phenomenon that happened on Friday night with the announced bombing of strategic chemical weapons targets in Syria in the real world. And it kind of had a little bit of a S.H.I.E.L.D. flavor to it, but at the same time, it really kind of messed up people's viewing. I mean, you know, not to belittle the happenings in real life in any way, but at the same time, people really had a hard time watching this episode.
Well, yeah. And, you know, we've said all along that generally you and I watch it Saturday morning for the first time. But because my wife was occupied with something else, I thought, well, I'll check in on S.H.I.E.L.D. She's going to be another half hour. So it's like 9:03. I figure I'll go back to the beginning. And of course, ABC News is on. Fortunately for me, I had the foresight to go in and tape 2020, which is the show that follows it, figuring, you know, they're going to screw up everybody's DVR. So,
yeah, well, even though the delayed opening was one thing, but apparently they had interruptions during commercials, too. So I definitely am sorry for those of you out there in the listening audience that had to deal with that. Hopefully this podcast will serve in some ways to fill in some of those gaps for you. But as we get closer to the end of the season, I also wanted to take this time to mention, if I haven't already, it's probably come into our discussion obliquely here and there, but just wanted to let you know that Dave and I have other podcasts going. I think people in general know about Sci-Fi Fidelity, our genre television podcast that we've been doing since January of 2016. But we've also started another one called the Den of Geek Podcast, or as we affectionately call it, G-News, which just started this January, and we've reached our sixth episode on that, where we just talk about general entertainment news, Dave and I do. And it's a short format podcast, about a half an hour long, so easy to digest. And I don't know that everyone in our listening audience knew about that, so I just wanted to bring that up front. And what are you guys covering on Sci-Fi TV Rewatch these days, Dave?
Well, we have returned to Dollhouse. We're in season two, getting ready to do episode five. But, you know, I sent Wayne a Facebook message. Hey, what do you think about doing the Lost in Space pilot? And then we'll get back to Dollhouse. So, you know, we'll finish off season two of Dollhouse. And after that, not sure.
So if you haven't gotten a chance to listen to Dave and my other podcasts, including ones where I'm not hosting with them. And I also, of course, still do 12 Monkeys for season four. One last time, 10 episodes this summer with Corey. But go to denofgeek.com or just search Den of Geek in iTunes and you'll find both Sci-Fi Fidelity and the Den of Geek podcast, and sci-fi-tv-rewatch.com is where you can find Dave and Wayne.
Yeah, and I can't speak highly enough of Mike and Corey making sense of 12 Monkeys for me, because I'm generally lost by the end of each
episode. And we're looking to maybe have Terry Metalis, the showrunner of that show, on for as many episodes of our podcast as possible, because he really wants to dive in full bore. So I can't wait to see how that turns out.
Yeah, it's cool.
But lots of podcasts to enjoy once this one's over, but let's go ahead and dive right in with our episode discussion.
All All right, Mike. Well, the team is still split. I mean, we did have Daisy, of course, rescuing Coulson, but Fitzsimmons and Yo-Yo are trying to find the weapon. Daisy, May, and Deke rescue Coulson and Talbot, and then, of course, they get back and find Mac and Piper trying to save Deke's life. So, you know, I think one thing S.H.I.E.L.D. does well, it splits the team up, but doesn't keep them apart for very long.
Right, and every storyline feels cohesive, separate from the others. I've never had a problem with choppiness in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is nice. That happens in some other shows.
Yeah, now you said cohesiveness, and I would agree. Believability, we'll get to that in a few minutes.
Yeah, but that's true.
But there is a theme of reckless behavior that's been running through not only this episode, but even the previous one. And I think we said last time, you know, there have to be some real consequences for these actions. Everybody can't just get back to Zephyr or get back to the lighthouse and say, oh, I'm glad everybody's safe. Is this great? No, yeah. There's a lot of things that need to be addressed.
Well, not to mention, I think there's so much finality in a lot of what's going on here that I get to the point where, as optimistically as I look at a renewal for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., everything that they're doing seems so final. And, you know, of course, I'm not saying that relationships can't be mended based on mistakes that were made or decisions that were made, but it really just has that flavor to it sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think the first thing we need to look at is the fact that reckless actions apparently run in the Fitzsimmons family because...
Oh my gosh, yes.
I mean, certainly Deke...
I can't believe he did that.
Well, I know that, but from my perspective, they all put the team at risk, certainly by not following orders. I mean, number one, there is no medic on call. And you know, I'll deal with Piper in a few minutes. But that's not to say Simmons can't go into the field. But if we're sending Simmons into the field, then I'm sure other arrangements have been made in case the rest of the team that's not in the field needs a medic. So, you know, right off the bat, that still bothers me a lot.
Oh, yeah, because they were already going to be in trouble, Fitz and Simmons and Elena, for doing what they did. But now that they've put a team member's life in danger by not being there, or Simmons not being there specifically, that ups the amount of comeuppance that's coming their way.
Yeah. Now, the other thing about Fitz and Simmons, I think Simmons, even more so than Fitz, and certainly Yo-Yo, that whole idea of invincibility, and there's at least one occasion where they're kind of surprised that they survived.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, what happened to the invincible trio here?
Well, yeah, especially Fitz. And I'm kind of bothered by the role reversal here because I still maintain that Simmons's actions this episode and in last episode were a little bit out of character for her. But okay, she's a scientist. She's convinced. But Fitz should be even more hardcore convinced. And I kind of chalked a little bit of his hesitancy last week up to his emotional response at Simmons' test of the invincibility factor. But in this episode, he didn't have that excuse. So I really felt like him admitting that he wasn't so sure for a little while there. I'm like, what? Come on. If you're going to be convinced and you're going to go out and do this, what you're doing here, they should have been solid as a rock in their conviction. Narratively speaking, they should have.
Oh, absolutely. And look, I love the gunfight. The action sequences in this episode were really tight and well-placed and couldn't have been done better. I love during the gunfight when Simmons' gun jams and she's getting a little nervous. And again, I'm thinking, well, what happened to the invincibility factor? But she tells Fitz to talk to her about the timeline and being able to change it. And he starts bringing up Minkowski, who I think most of us first encountered during Lost way back when, if you remember. And then she goes, nope, not helping. Stop.
Yeah. It's like she needs to be talked into it too. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously I understand under duress when you're being tested there, it's not exactly the same being in a gunfight as, you know, doing a test where you're drinking water or phosphoric acid. But, and the fact that they even mentioned at one point that you're never sure when is that time going to come when a new decision might enter the mix, and right, that would take the invincibility away.
Right. And that, in fact, happens in that scene because obviously they're fighting off Ruby and Strucker, and Simmons and Fitz realize they never really had a choice about whether or not to repair the device that Fitz had smashed only moments earlier, because Ruby is telling them that you have to fix it. And they get into that just brief discussion about the fact that their selves always repair this device. I guess in whatever timeline it is and whatever reality is, they always repair the device. Now, do I have that right, or am I confused?
No, you totally have that right. They realize that what they're doing here is likely to have occurred in many loops already, and that they haven't reached that point yet where a new decision is made. But they still have to try. I mean, I think if they had had their druthers, they would have been able to destroy more things, but Fitz did the best he could. But yeah, I think in the back of their minds, they're thinking, this isn't enough.
Right. So I think for us, as we see the infusion chamber, which appears to be intact, it's a smaller device that obviously must run that needs to be repaired. But as Strucker and Ruby are holding weapons on our pair, we suspect somebody's going to come and rescue them before they actually repair the device, or will they?
Well, and usually you're in this position, but I'm in the position of having seen the preview this time. So those people who know that the device will have some functionality, but I also want to point out that Fitz did say to Simmons, man, I wish I'd kept a little bit more explosives from when they blew their way in there. And I think that probably could have gone a long way towards changing the timeline as well, had they done that. But, you know, you never can predict. Just because it works for you in the invincibility doesn't mean it works for you when you're trying to do things good, because, of course, you're not wanting to change the timeline in terms of your lifespan, but you are trying to change the timeline in terms of what happens, and you can't have it both ways.
Right. And from a narrative perspective, I think they have to get this machine repaired, because in the back of our minds, there's still the question of whether or not Daisy is going to have an impact in blowing up the Earth, if in fact we reach that point, which I assume we won't. But
my theory is that the infusion chamber, whether it's with Ruby or someone else, but I don't think it's going to be Daisy at all. I think Ruby's going to do something, or the chamber's going to do something that will start the catastrophe, and Daisy will just be on her way to stop it. That's the same thing that we speculated about Daisy's involvement way back when, in the first half of the season. So I'm not at this point thinking that Daisy's going to get a chance at the infusion chamber at all.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Now, I think maybe the most significant reveal, and this is a reveal for the characters, because of course we've known this for a while, but it occurs when Yo-Yo tells Fitz and Simmons that they need to let Coulson die,
right,
in order to save the Earth. And, you know, we know what she's talking about, and you know, she doesn't have a whole lot of chance to go into depth, but now what?
Yeah, I mean, are they going to buy that? Because, of course, their goals are different from saving Coulson right now anyway. So I'm not sure it would have occurred to them to let him die or not let him die until after they're finished this part of the mission. So I think that just gives them a heads up for when it comes into play. Are they going to be able to follow her lead on that, or try to convince others to follow her lead on that? Because at least it gives them a slight edge, but will it be enough?
Well, right. And the twist here is that Coulson wants to die,
right,
because he feels it's what's necessary for everything to, or maybe it's probably not fair to say he wants to die.
No, that's a little overstating it, but he's ready for it and he thinks it's inevitable.
Right. He's come to that, you know, feeling of inevitability. And look, obviously we all are going to die. That's inevitable. But in his case, because whatever that is on his chest.
Right. And I think probably the most successful part of this episode is in that small conversation between him and May about that.
Now, that brings up Coulson and whether or not he's behaving recklessly. I mean, I love the conversation when May tells him, you know, we've got to have a chat, and he thinks it's something mission related. And I guess in a sense it is.
Yeah.
Because she wants him to explain all the stupid decisions you've been making lately. And, you know, we've talked about Daisy in charge, May as her de facto number two, really trying to guide her through the process, not unlike Coulson having guided Sky and now Daisy. But I love when she explains to him that she's just not ready, that she will be, I have no doubt, but you're asking too much. But we understand his perspective as well, that he doesn't know how much time he has. So she's going to have to be ready.
Right. But I think the point is very well made by May, in that it's not just the fact that Daisy's not ready. It's that all of her decisions are also reckless, because she's focused on saving him. And so him wanting her to go off in her own direction for the betterment of S.H.I.E.L.D. is not working. You know, she's putting all her resources into getting him back.
Right. And it's an interesting dilemma, because they certainly have been a unit that follows the leave no man or woman behind. But the fate of the Earth is at stake here.
Right. And so that kind of begs the question, if Coulson hadn't given himself up, I mean, obviously he makes a good argument also about getting his intel and Talbot and all that, but would Daisy have gone in a different direction if she hadn't had to save Coulson? Would she have started to go after the machine the way Elena and Fitz and Simmons have? I mean, it's an interesting speculation to think, would she have done a better job as a leader had she not had to save Coulson's ass?
Well, right. And I guess we'd have to look at the timetable with the weapon, and whether by taking the time to save Coulson first, so that we've got the full team, we've got our leader, now let's go after the weapon, was it a time-sensitive operation? I'm not convinced it was.
No. In fact, I think the only reason the timetable got moved up is because Ruby forced the issue, not that Hale would have.
Right. And then, of course, I think we all love at the end of the conversation when May tells him, this is not your decision to make. The people that love you deserve, you know, some input. And I love you.
I knew that would shut you up.
That was just beautiful on so many levels.
Well, I mean, it was just so great compared to the May that we saw during the LMD days. This is much more the delivery that we would expect from our May.
Right. Now, obviously, we can look at Daisy's plan to go save Coulson first as a mistake. And, you know, whether it is or not, we could debate that, as we were just saying. But does she make a mistake allowing Talbot to phone his wife? And it gets me to think, what would Coulson have done in that same position?
Well, I think it is very unique to Daisy. And I do think it's a mistake, because she's trying to make up for her LMD having shot him. Even though she has no responsibility in that regard, she feels bad. And I don't think Coulson would have done that. Now, the question becomes, would Talbot have begged for it such that the decision was kind of forced? But I don't know, because it definitely is something that Hale predicted that he would do, because otherwise the whole ending wouldn't have been put into place. But would cooler heads have realized that it would be dangerous to let him do this, even with a phone that was relayed through several different relays? Because it doesn't matter, obviously, that it's encrypted in this case.
Okay, but what about when she brings up her own father at the end of that conversation?
Yeah,
That it really made it personal for her, and she understood, as she says, you know, I wish I had known my father cared. So that still doesn't mean Coulson would have let him do it. You know, Coulson doesn't have children, so, you know, he might not have seen it from the same perspective as she did. But obviously, Hale's assistant is with Talbot's wife. So do we assume she's being threatened? Is it possible she's Hydra herself?
You know what? I guess I think that she just doesn't know what this phrase means. Her husband's been away for months. Perhaps this person came in and sweet-talked her way into saying, you know, Talbot's been away on this mission for the Air Force, and we just need you to read him this. This is a code phrase that's being given to tell him what the next step is, or something like that. And they're just involving it in this manner, which she thinks is completely innocuous. So I think she's just reading it, not even under duress. It's possible they're threatening her also, but I definitely don't think she's Hydra. I don't think she's complicit.
Okay. Now, there have been a lot of great secondary characters through the 5-season run of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but Glenn Talbot, I mean, he's come so far from when we first meet him, but now it's just really difficult to feel anything but pity for him. I mean, yeah, he's alive. He's got, you know, a good portion of his brain function back, but he's just really a shell of the man that we know. And that scene where he and Coulson are trying to find their way out of the wilderness without any cold weather gear. And then that explanation that he feels he's let everybody down, even my country. Ah, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. And he starts talking to himself too. And so you can really be reminded of the damage that's been done. And in hindsight, I almost feel like we should have seen where this was headed. Now, it's been a long time since Agent 33 back in season 3, where we saw the, you know, the compliance brainwashing, but seeing the damage that was done and knowing that they were trying to get information out of Talbot, but would torture be enough to put him in this mental state? Maybe not. But what would be enough would be that compliance, those films that they would show nonstop to kind of hypnotize them into it. I mean, that is something that I can believe would break Talbot down.
Okay. Well, do you think he can regain his wits, so to speak? I mean, you know, we've only got 5 episodes left to go in this season, so.
Well, Agent 33 did, so why not Talbot?
Okay, good. Now, we talked about Ruby and Strucker last week, and clearly they're working together. He's made progress. He's figured out what's going on. So what's their plan, and is their plan reckless as well? I mean, I think we'd have to say yes, right?
Oh, for sure. And I think everyone is being reckless. I think you're right to call that a theme of the episode, because obviously Strucker is kind of honing in on this idea that Ruby is destined for this. But Ruby has been reckless even, you know, when she just threw her bladed hoop into Carl Creel last week. Stuff like that, it really shows that she's not necessarily thinking it through or acting as calm and cool and collected as she needs to be in order to carry out what she wants to have happen. But at the same time, she does get the better of her mother.
Yeah, but then do they think they know better than General Hale? Because I don't believe General Hale has probably explained the entire plan to her daughter, and certainly not to Strucker. So they don't know really what the big picture is.
Well, I got the impression that General Hale was pretty upfront about not knowing and wanted to get Carl Creel in back, even though he betrayed them. They're talking about how they're still willing to work with him to see what this infusion chamber will do before they put Ruby into it. She just wants to skip right to the good stuff. But at the same time, I think it's interesting that Strucker tells Ruby that he's found all the notes that they need, and it seems like he only tells her. He did not deliver that information to General Hale. So I think that that's the one point in their favor, is that they have a little bit more knowledge than the general does.
Okay. Now, she mentions, the general that is, intending to put Ivanov in the chamber first to see what happens.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? I mean, is she trying to convince him that it will help him get back with his body somehow, or make, because Ivanov seems to say, one more step in my quest to become the most perfect human. I'm not sure how the infusion chamber helps him do that, but I get the sense that it has something to do with combining his LMD-ness with the head that's left in the jar somehow, such that he transcends both forms somehow.
Okay. And I thought I heard Hale say something about wanting to see how human skin reacts, and then, well, does that mean he has human skin? That, right, a cyborg is a machine with human skin,
right,
over top.
So, well, since when he was, the body that Ivanov is currently in is one of the Ada made LMDs, which is much more superior. It uses the technology from the Darkhold. So yeah, I do think it's actual flesh. It's just not his.
Okay. All right. Now, Hale knows Ruby's not ready to take on Daisy. And this is one of my issues with this episode. And again, don't get me wrong, I love the episode. I'm loving the show. But there's no darn way Ruby should be able to take on Daisy. And in fact, when they fight, it's almost as if Daisy, you know,
she's holding back.
Why?
I don't know. Same thing with Carl Creel. How is she beating him even a little bit? She did better against Daisy than she did against Carl Creel, and it should have been the reverse.
And really only because Daisy, as you said, just took it easy on her. And look, Daisy's not a killer. We understand that. But at some point, the tough decisions have to be made. This is, I mean, are Ruby and Strucker next-gen Hydra?
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be. I'm not sure that's going to happen now. But yeah, I think that was the intention.
All right, well, let's jump to, I think, my biggest... No, I don't think. I know my biggest nitpick with this episode, and that's the rush to save Deke's life. And Mac and Piper operating successfully on Deke.
No doubt I had a problem with that. I'm sure many of the people in the listening audience did as well.
Right. Okay. No doctor since Simmons went on her rogue mission. They can't reach her. They're heading for the lighthouse. They get Deke stabilized, and Daisy tells him, rightly so, that his actions were reckless. I can't fight and protect your dumbass at the same time. And again, the one scene that is the saving grace in all of this is when the operation's over, he's alive, he's recovering, but he's heavily doped up. It's like, is Daisy here? She's pretty.
Yeah. Well, it's almost as though the entire point of having him shot and having Mac and Piper work on him is so that we can have this scene. It's a confessional of sorts, right?
Yeah.
Because I look back and I trace over the actions. I'm thinking, why did they have to have him shot at all? I mean, he came back because he cares for her and he wants to be useful in some way. But to have him shot and to force this situation to come up could only mean one of two things. Either it was engineered just to give us this moment of him under drugs admitting his feelings, or it's going to be something that exacerbates the problems between the team, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, where they already were going to be in trouble. Now they're even in more trouble because Mac and Piper had to perform his procedure. So I just don't get the reason for it otherwise. And in fact, even if it was just about Deke getting injured, the fact that Mac and Piper are the ones doing it stretches credibility so thin as to be almost ridiculous.
Right. And look, we understand. We've taken that leap. I mean, we accept that there are inhumans. We accept that the Chitauri invaded New York, that the Kree are. But this is different. It really is. Well, Piper, you've had medical field training, which clearly, because she says she didn't finish it. So she's going to operate on Deke. Mac says, well, I've got a steady hand. I'll do the heavy lifting. You just tell me what to do. We'll figure it out as we go. And then they get to the point where they nick an artery, clamping. I mean, come on, really?
Yeah, I was with them until the artery, because, you know, they could just kind of fudge their way through removing a bullet as long as they only had to suture a very easy wound, or even if it didn't get too many veins that could be healed. But an artery is much different because you have to sew the actual wall of the artery, and that's no mean feat. In fact, they just have Piper mention that to Mac, and then they cut from the scene altogether, and then he's fine later. So we just have to kind of take it on faith, and it was already tough to have faith in this whole scene.
Yeah, and I'm not saying I want Deke to die.
No.
But I almost thought for a little bit there that he would die, because then that would impact Fitz and Simmons' assessment of the timeline and the loop that they've been in. And
yeah, that's what I thought too. Although that wouldn't violate anything, because of course Deke coming back to the past and dying doesn't affect his being born later. So that's everything's still intact in that sense, but it would be a very senseless death that would cause them to reflect.
Right. Now Daisy comes in after they knock Deke out because they just couldn't stand listening to him anymore. And you see Piper's ready to say something.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. And just that really subtle response from Mac that, yeah, no.
Yeah. He kind of just gives her a look. And in fact, that in some ways redeemed the scene, the whole Deke humor and the Mac aftermath. So it kind of left me feeling a little bit better so that I didn't have a bad taste in my mouth. It kind of just made me smile.
Yeah. Now, another thing from a technical standpoint has to do with Yo-Yo's arms, and you know, when they're trapped in the Hydra lab, her arms apparently weren't calibrated to sustain the speed at which her body can move.
Yeah, now this I thought was really cool, because I didn't think about it, and I feel like we maybe should have realized that there might be a problem in that regard.
Yeah. Now, why didn't Fitz think about that to begin with?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he's had a lot on his mind. I certainly think that's fair to say. But, you know, we get to the epilogue and, you know, this is the scene where Daisy comes in to see Talbot and gives him the phone so he can call his wife. And, you know, as you said, she's reading from a script and he's ready to comply. So what does that mean? Does he have commands built in? Because I would think, I mean, certainly this happens in Dollhouse, now that you mention it, where, you know, the sleeper actives have those commands built in, but somebody has to trigger them. So who will now orally trigger any commands that Talbot might have built in?
Oh, well, I think it must just be, you know, are you ready to comply? And he maybe already has his orders. Is that possible? Kind of like, you remember in the season one of Jessica Jones, that girl who was kind of trapped in her apartment and then killed her parents. That was implanted, even though, you know, Jessica had supposedly rescued her. You know, that kind of thing, where the signal is already there. Once they're activated, the mission is built in.
Ah, a little Marvel crossover. I like it. But anything else you want to bring up about this one?
No, I think we covered it. It's really just all the same misgivings. And it's interesting to note that in past seasons of this podcast, Dave and I would always talk about it at work, but Dave is retired now and I don't get to have pre-podcast discussions. And yet we obviously saw eye to eye on just about everything. So I think that speaks well to maybe the general opinion. And again, we liked the episode and we don't mind nitpicking when it's deserved and realizing that it still doesn't lower our opinion of the show. But, you know, I think this one deserved a little bit of roughhousing.
Yeah, because as you said, I mean, from a narrative perspective, if they want to have Deke express how he feels about Daisy, there are other ways they could have done it.
Right, exactly. It did seem to be. You talk about recklessness on the part of the characters. Maybe this was recklessness on the part of the writers. But we still had some fun, humorous moments to share. And Faith's got her Colsass report for us this week again. So let's go ahead and listen to the winner from last week and the choices for this week.
Hello, everyone. It's time for the Colsass report. This episode had a few good moments where Sass absolutely released some tension. But before I get to those, here's the winner from last week. Not at all surprised that most of you chose my favorite, Evil League of Evil.
You can tell the general there's nothing you can do to make me join her Evil League of Evil.
I'm not her messenger boy.
And now for this week's contenders. Number one, accurate description.
Where were you?
We're in the future.
You're in the future. What, you guys live in some fifth dimension freak show?
I'd say that's a relatively accurate description of our day-to-day life.
Number two, cheating.
So how'd you find us?
Robin.
It's a little bit like cheating, don't you think?
Keep moving.
Number three, I love you.
You don't get to make that decision alone. That decision is made with the people who love you.
May.
And that's me. I love you. I thought that would shut you up.
And number four, it's not helping.
Fitz, just tell me it's against the law of physics. I need that right now.
The perception of time is an illusion.
Last month.
According to Harmon Minkowski, space-time...
No, you know what? I was wrong. It's not helping.
Did I miss your favorite moment? We can't have that. Please be sure to join Taltos next week in tweeting your favorites to FBMC with the hashtag Colsass. To vote for this week's contenders, please visit facebook.com/groups/agentsofshieldgsm. While you do that, I'm going to come up with some cool handshakes. Have a great week, everybody.
All right, some good ones there. And so if you want to go ahead and vote on the Facebook group, it's at facebook.com/groups/agentsofshieldgsm. And it's interesting, I think, every week to see the Colsass report and how many votes it gets, because it reminds me of how many people are in that Facebook group. It's really kind of remarkable the number of votes that gets and how integral to the podcast Faith's Colsass report has become.
Yeah, and just how everybody views SAS differently.
That's for sure. I always go for the one that is specifically designed to be sarcastic and biting, and usually Coulson as well. Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead into our feedback. And we've got a couple that we'll start off with here from last week. And so I'll read one of those, and Dave's got one as well. The first one is Rainbird. Rainbird says, "Hey guys, I need a physics refresher. I feel like Deke and his brain pretzel trying to figure out the origins, uses, and interactions of the various super elements in S.H.I.E.L.D. Let's start with gravitonium. Was it brought to Earth by the Kree in ancient times as part of their experiments to turn humanity into more efficient slaves, and then discovered and developed by Hydra for their own nefarious purposes? We know Hydra planned to use it in the infusion chamber, but was it also part of the Super Soldier program and Captain America's upgrade?" And just to pause here, gravitonium actually was something that was discovered and looked for specifically in the earlier parts of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. In fact, we mentioned last week that season 1, episode 3 is the one that dealt with gravitonium. So I think they found it in some caves or something like that, if I remember correctly from the comics references that were there at the time. But no, it wasn't discovered by or developed by Hydra. It was completely separate from that. Quinn was the one trying to develop it for his own selfish reasons, I believe, not Hydra.
Does it have an atomic number?
Something high, I imagine.
Okay.
Was gravitonium part of the blue stuff used to resurrect Coulson and Tahiti and later Yo-Yo in the fractured future? Or is that substance composed solely of Kree blood? I think the Kree blood formula, although it definitely doesn't contain gravitonium, might be a compound of some sort. I don't think it's just Kree blood. I could be wrong about that. Also, what about the monoliths? Where did they come from? Well, I don't think that one has an answer. Something Kree related is all I know. They look similar to gravitonium in their liquid form, and maybe that's just because the special effects department used the same template for both elements. I guess we could get into vibranium too, but I don't think it's appeared in S.H.I.E.L.D., and we know it came to Wakanda via meteorite. Yeah, I think you answered your own question there. Lots of questions. Feel free to pick and choose amongst them. Best from Northwest Nowhere on the Northern California coast. All right, well, thank you, Rainbird, and hopefully we answered your questions there.
Okay. All right, we heard from Sci-Fi Gene, who says, "This is late feedback for episode 16, Inside Voices. I think that Gemma did take a precaution before executing her plan, just not a very intelligent precaution. Earlier in the episode, she asked Deke if he remembered whether or not her future self got sick."
Oh, did she?
Yes, she did. "I believe she asked this question because she thought that if something bad was going to happen to her, then Deke would remember it, or at least remember a story about it."
Oh, very good. Okay. I didn't notice that. Good eye, Sci-Fi Gene. All right. Well, let's go ahead into this week's feedback, and we'll start with Skimmins. Skimmins says, "I look forward to using your recap this week to watch the show, quote unquote, as the news break before it and the commercial schedule inserts during it really made for inconsistent viewing for the first portion of the show. They had me fooled at first, I have to say, acting as if they would just preempt the episode, but the moment they went from Daisy saying they would never find Coulson on Zephyr to a commercial and backed to Coulson and Talbot running from Ruby, I knew they were just going to play the episode out. It would be annoying no matter what, but given this could be some of the final episodes, it was really annoying." Yeah, so sorry that people had to deal with that. That really stinks. And especially those people who DVR'd it. Oh my gosh, that must have been a real pain. I think Christopher Bork, in fact, he's been trying to catch up so he could listen to our podcast and participate, and he just got caught up right before this episode, and then this happened. Regarding the parts I did get to see, the Ruby-Daisy fight was really good, but they feel inconsistent when it comes to Ruby, as one week she easily handles Carl, but this week Daisy schools her at every turn. Oh, I thought it was the other way around, but yeah, I mean, you obviously honed in on the same thing we did there. We later see Hale easily manhandle her against a wall, so are her powers linked to a certain thing? Or is she just, as some have wondered, skilled but not as enhanced as it sounds with how much she throws around the word? Is she actually powerful, but Daisy just got the better of her? Another awesome moment was Hale's strut out of the trees. That was grade A level evil swagger. I believe it was Mike, my apologies if it was you, Dave, who said last week the convenience of some plots can bring moments down, and this week that felt really true for me with the whole Piper training to be a field medic part and Mac throwing out the fact he had steady hands just to keep them from taking Deke to a hospital and risk exposure that way. Yes, they were clearly inexperienced, but still, it felt convenient and thus not as good as the situation might have been drama-wise. And I think you know, Skimmins, that we definitely agree with you on that one. A great scene between May and Coulson in the tunnel. Her saying she loves him definitely adds to the final season debate, as they drug that plot out forever, so answering it canonically now makes it feel like this is the final for sure, especially with everything else that's happened this season, such as callbacks and guest stars. I love Gemma using her smarts to figure out the flowers earlier and the fire hose puzzle in this episode. Props to Dove Cameron for the crying scene, a fun slow-motion gunfight with Gemma and Fitz, but I, of course, would have enjoyed it more if it was Daisy and Gemma, or even Fitzsimmons as friends, siblings fighting together. Drugged Deke was funny. I can't rate this episode this week due to the airing issues, but what I saw seemed interesting. And I don't think she could have encapsulated our entire podcast discussion better in one email than what she did there. So nice job, Skimmins.
Yeah, now just two things real quickly. I do agree. Ruby doesn't have any powers. She has skills. Now, she may end up with powers once she gets into the infusion chamber. Mm-hmm. And then the crying scene was classic because it was great, but we knew where it was headed. We knew it was a con. And then her mother throwing her against the wall. I don't know that her mother has any powers either that we've seen. Why doesn't the daughter fight back? I think because this is her mother.
Well, and the thing about it is she may have been crying crocodile tears, but I think she was being truthful when she said that her mother is her weakness, the same way Alex thought it was, and she is her mother's weakness at the same time. So I think a lot of what Ruby does, even when it's deception, is based on seeds of truth.
Right. All right. Well, we heard from Tautos, who says, when Ruby went after Coulson and Talbot, her outfit appeared quite impractical. She didn't need to hide her identity, as both of them already knew who she was. However, Ruby still put on a mask and a hood, which must be a serious impediment when tracking someone. I know the Invincible Three's mission was thrown together last minute, but it seems really irresponsible to not have Elena try out her powers a few times before heading into the field. Yeah, that's a good point.
Another recklessness point there.
Given S.H.I.E.L.D.'s luck in general, they should have anticipated that Elena would need to use her powers sooner rather than later and run a few tests. And I didn't really think about it, but I mean, take an athlete that's coming off of a knee injury. Of course they would go out and work out and see what they can do and what they can't do.
Right. And I think Fitz intimated that he could just recalibrate them and it would work fine. But maybe this will keep her from using her powers in the future episodes as well. So we shall see. All right. I want to do one thing that I don't usually do, and that's pull a comment from Facebook from Carmelita, because I think she just had a great way of putting all the different things that we've been discussing in this podcast today with regard to recklessness. And the way Carmelita puts it is that one weakness for each character was a major thread running through all the storylines this week. It's really interesting, and I can't wait to see how this plays out. Daisy's love for Coulson is affecting her ability to lead effectively. Deke's infatuation with Daisy and desire to impress her leads him to disobey orders, ending up in the line of fire. Poor Talbot calls his wife, even though it's a majorly stupid move that Hale was counting on. Gemma's love for Fitz has her doubling down on this assertion that they can't be killed, taking crazy risks that get them captured. Fitz is having doubts about the theory, but he goes along because he'll never be separated from Gemma again. Hate to say it, but I think these two are blowing it, and there should be major consequences. Even the villains were bested because they let the personal get in the way of the larger objective. Ruby stops to fight Daisy, hoping to prove herself worthy, but it backfires. And Hale is still stalling on moving forward with putting Ruby through the machine, and it gives Ruby the chance to mutiny. So I don't think we've ever seen a more pervasive thematic unity of this idea of recklessness and weakness, or an Achilles heel for each character, if you will, than what we saw this week. And as a thematic element, I think it's really cool, but it also kind of makes us frustrated, I think, even when it's used correctly.
Yeah, and certainly Carmelita succinctly brought it all together in a tremendous way. But I guess I do like the fact that it's both sides.
Yeah.
Right. Everybody's acting recklessly. And I guess when we look at the gravity of the situation, certainly from the SHIELD team's perspective about knowing what happens to future Earth, there is maybe the tendency to do something before you're ready. Now, I don't want to make excuses for them, because I still go back to Simmons and Fitz and their reckless behavior, and Yo-Yo as well, puts the whole team at risk.
Yeah.
And I think in a different way than, say, what Daisy's doing.
Right. And I think those are the ones we hone in on as sometimes character flaws, but also sometimes narrative flaws as well, rather than just a character making a mistake, which we can understand. So it's interesting how each one is interpreted differently. But I just thought Carmelita did a good job of encapsulating that on Facebook. So I wanted to share that one as a feedback, and she agreed to share it that way. So thank you very much to Carmelita and all the rest of the people who contributed feedback this week. But that's going to be it for this edition of The Sandbox. Keep up with show news and fan interaction by following us on Twitter at @Shield_GSM. And our popular Facebook group is at facebook.com/groups/AgentsOfShieldGSM, which is also where you can vote on the Kolsas Report.
And Mike and I will be back next week with our discussion of episode 18 of season 5, entitled All Roads Lead. But remember, after the episode airs, head on over to goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback to share your thoughts. You can write a message, record a comment using your computer's microphone, or call 304-837-2278.
And if you get a chance, please rate and review The Sandbox wherever you get your podcasts to let us know how you're enjoying our coverage of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
And remember, like Mac doing a complex surgical procedure, we're just figuring this out as we go along.